Welcome to this month's edition of Arizona MCast. That's the name we decided to go with. And if you can think of a better name, I'd love to hear it. Seriously, I'd love to hear it. I got a nice response from the first podcast. Lots of different requests, lots of people that said they liked it. Surprisingly, no one said they didn't like the sound of my voice, which is very kind of everybody. One thing I did hear is that people want to have some kind of a format. They want sections. They want something that's going to be consistent. So we're going to do a couple things based on feedback from you guys. The first thing we're going to do is Jared Mosier is going to do a review of EM blogs and podcasts of what's kind of the hot thing going on right now and give you his kind of condensed version as well as a little bit of his own opinion. The other thing we're going to do is we're going to have a discussion from several different faculty members, nurses, social workers, people outside our department on more of the clinical series that we were doing before. A little more of the clinical style points, not the core content that you're going to get in conference, but again, a supplement to that. So we've taken some time and interviewed people to see what makes a successful code. How do we run a good code? Outcomes not always set, but we can run a good code every time and get better and hopefully have better outcomes each time that we do it. The last thing that we're going to do is we're going to spend a little time on everyone's favorite topic, documentation. Now that I've completely lost everyone, I seriously got a lot of feedback that people want to hear more about documentation. They want to hear more about how we bill. But what they don't want is an hour-long session, which is really all we're able to offer in conference. Instead, what we're going to do is we're going to do 5 to 10 minutes once a month and talk about a portion of documentation or a portion of billing. And hopefully by doing this, this is more along the lines of what you guys want. It'll better prepare you for the real world when this really does matter. Now, to answer some of your other questions, I am not technologically savvy, but I do own a Mac and a microphone. That's how I'm able to do this. So setting up an RSS feed, setting up a discussion forum on a website, setting up a website on its own, not going to happen right away, but I'm working on it. We'll try to make this easier for you guys to access it, to access old copies, to try to have some transcripts or transcript-like scrawlings that go out with this. But for right now, bear with me. We can start or continue discussions on the listserv, but if that starts to be more of a pain and people don't like all the constant chatter that goes on the listserv, I can try to develop something else. You guys let me know what works for you and what doesn't.
I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket. I'm looking for a come up. This is Trolling the Web.
So we want to do a series on this podcast called Trolling the Web. And I thought about this because the free open access medical education movement, Twitter, blogs, and podcasts seems to be taking over. It's a decentralized way of getting medical education. But with that decentralized method, you get a lot of creativity, but you also get a lot of chaos. What I mean by that is you get a lot of people who are thought leaders in emergency medicine or claim to be thought leaders in emergency medicine who put out a lot of good discussion on the internet. But you also get a lot of people who just have something to say and don't really have anything to back it up with.
Jared, I think you just described us.
But I don't think that the free open access medical education movement is going anywhere. In fact, I think we should embrace it. I just think that it is a method for us to have discussion when people put out points. So what I envision this section of the podcast to be is if you hear something or see something in a podcast, Twitter, blog, whatever, let us know about it and we can discuss it. What I wanted to discuss today was there seems to be a lot of chatter on the blogosphere lately about pulmonary embolism and the management of patients with pulmonary embolism with thrombolytics. We discussed recently the Moffitt trial, and there is another blog called EM Nerd, which is a second-year emergency medicine resident in New York who posted a long blog and actually cited some references about why to not use thrombolytics in pulmonary embolism. But first, let's talk about the Moffitt trial. The Moffitt trial was moderate pulmonary embolism treated with thrombolysis. Their rationale was that the pulmonary circulation gets all of the cardiac output, as opposed to like the brain that only gets a percentage of the cardiac output. So giving somebody thrombolytics, all of that dose of thrombolytics is going to go to the pulmonary circulation. So could you decrease the amount of bleeds by giving half dose of thrombolytics? So what this group did was they took patients who had a moderate pulmonary embolism, which they defined as the presence or signs and symptoms of PE plus CT imaging that shows greater than 70% involvement in greater than or equal to two lobes or the left or right pulmonary artery. And what they did was they took this group of patients who had a moderate pulmonary embolism and they gave them half-dose TPA versus not half-dose TPA. And their endpoint was pulmonary artery systolic pressure 2 years later. And their secondary endpoint was the amount of bleeds. Now, if you look at the eligibility requirements of this study, they had to have an acute pulmonary embolism, but they were excluded if they were hypotensive. If their systolic blood pressure was less than 95, they were excluded from this trial. So they were truly looking at symptomatic pulmonary embolism of moderate size, but not quote-unquote submassive pulmonary embolism. And they gave half dose of TPA, and they gave it as an initial 10 milligram bolus, and then over 2 hours with the rest of the infusion. And what they found was that at 2 years or 28 months, plus or minus 5 months, they had a decrease in pulmonary hypertension, and they had no patients with significant bleeds. And their rationale and the enthusiasm that this has led to in emergency medicine since this study was published is that for patients who come in with acute pulmonary embolism, we can go ahead and give half-dose TPA, and it's perfectly safe. Now, I have a couple issues with this trial. The first is that they're only looking at moderate pulmonary embolism. The patients who had hypotension or had submassive pulmonary embolisms were excluded from the trial, and they were given full-dose TPA. Secondly, their outcomes. The definition of pulmonary hypertension is a mean pulmonary artery pressure greater than 25 or 30. It is not a systolic pressure greater than 40. So that outcome isn't really a hard outcome to determine whether somebody has pulmonary hypertension later on or not. What they did find, though, that was interesting was that there was no incidence of bleed. Now, this EM Nerd resident in New York is posting about the Pythos trial. And the Pythos trial is looking at patients with submassive pulmonary embolisms and looking to see if TPA will improve their outcomes or not. And that study is yet to be published. But this is a well-thought-out blog post, and it's well-referenced. However, I do have some problems with it. The first is that if you look at patients who have submassive pulmonary embolisms, they have right heart strain or hypoxemia. And this Moffitt trial does not answer the question of do they have more incidence of pulmonary hypertension 2 years later if we don't thrombolyze them. What we do know is last year in American Journal of Medicine, there were two trials published. It was actually on the same issue. One of them was looking at the incidence of bleed with thrombolytics for unstable pulmonary embolisms. And what they found was that the bleed rate for TPA was 0.9%, or 1% of patients who got TPA for a pulmonary embolism had an intracranial bleed or a catastrophic bleed. But what they did find was that for unstable patients with right heart strain, hypotension, cardiovascular compromise, or hypoxemia who got thrombolytics, their case fatality rate, and this was in almost 10,000 patients, was 8.4%, as opposed to 42% who got no thrombolytic therapy. That is a massive difference. And so because of that, I would still recommend following the CHEST guidelines, which is that if a patient comes in with a submassive pulmonary embolism with critical hypoxemia or more likely hemodynamic compromise to give that patient thrombolytics. Whether you choose to give them half dorsal or not, that is yet to be determined. I think that you can't answer that based on the Moffitt trial. And maybe you can answer that based on the Pythos trial when it gets published. So end of rant. Again, if you see something on a blog or hear something on a podcast or somebody posts something on Twitter, take it with caution. Let's discuss it. Send it in and we'll do some digging and come up with hopefully an evidence-based answer for you.
Nicely done, Moj. So if you guys liked that, if you liked being able to go over some of the hot new topics that are being discussed on the web and actually having a say in it, which you do now via email or via however else you'd like to get a hold of us, then let us know and we'll do something else. Especially if you start to hear something new on a blog or a podcast that you want to try or that you think would be something it would be good for all of your other residents, faculty, whoever else to know about, please let us know. We can try to publicize it a little bit more. Yeah. In the Ferrari or Jaguar, switching four lanes, top down, screaming out, money ain't a thing. Bubble hard in the double law, flashing the rings with the window crack, holla back, money ain't a thing. So now we're going to talk a little bit about documentation in the ED. Now, those of you that are 50 charts in the hole may just want to cringe a little bit and try to glean as much as you can from this. But this is important because even though it may not make as big of a difference to you now, you are now building habits that you will take with you into your actual job where people will care about your documentation and your billing. This is going to be something where we discuss all the aspects of documentation. I was taught that documentation is four things. It's an accurate record historically of what happened in the emergency department. It is a communication between providers. It is a billing document, and it is a medical legal document. So we'd like to try to cover all four aspects of that throughout the year as we do short little pieces on how to document all of your wonderful care in the emergency department. This month, we're going to talk with Kelly Kellen and Peggy Hatmaker, who are two of our billing and reimbursement people. They are gracious enough to sit down with us and talk about something that I thought would be a good start, very simple and very misunderstood, laceration repairs. So I'm sitting down here with Kelly and Peggy. And Kelly, would you mind just breaking down for us the difference between a simple, intermediate, and a complex laceration repair? Because I found it's not exactly what I think it is.
For a simple, please give us the specificity of the size. Always, always give us the circumstances under which it occurred. How did it occur? And anything else that's going on. Extremely, extremely important. For an intermediate, I need to know it's two layers. I need to know if you sutured both, or if you sutured one, and if you used Dermabond on the second, but it's still two layers. Or did you remove particular matter? Did you remove a pebble, grass, glass, something like that? Did you x-ray? All this is extremely important. Complex, it's two layers plus. Was there extensive, and I will always mispronounce, it's debridement or debridement? Is it stellate? Was it really, really, I mean, it was it a crush injury? Did you use,
mattress
sutures? You know, give us that kind of, that, without using the word complex, I know what you're doing.
So I had one of the residents tell me the other day, he was describing this complex lac repair that he did, and he had to sew up a kid's face where the laceration went past the vermilion border, and he said, and I billed it as a complex laceration. Is that the case?
No. He didn't. He documented it that way. He threw in the word complex. But I guarantee you, just the way you now showed me, I mean, that is not a complex lac. If you actually are suturing the outer layer, inner layer of the lip inside, that's an intermediate. It's the same thing. It's two layers, but it's not complex.
So the fact that we agonize over it and don't want this kid to go home with a funny scar does not make it complex.
No, but we appreciate it. And again, we need the size of it. It still pays very well. Anything on the face has the highest RVUs, meaning it has the highest value. It's valued higher than a lac on the arm or extremity. It's valued higher than any other area of the body.
Okay.
And the allowables for those are higher, so we are reimbursed at a higher rate.
So people value their faces.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. So we'll let you guys decide whether it's simple, intermediate, or complex. You just want us to put those factors down, we'll let you do that part.
Exactly.
Because, again, complex to us means that we sweated and agonized over whether or not that person was going to be okay. So
it's just important to describe it. When we're ever asked to provide the medical record, should we receive a denial for a laceration, it's really important that you have identified it appropriately and described it in the dictation.
Okay.
Because they're looking for that. We want to substantiate that fee because the laceration charges are are higher.
And I'm looking at a piece of paper that you have here that you give me. So the three different types of lacs that we can bill for: simple laceration, intermediate laceration, and complex laceration. And you got a couple numbers here. The intermediate laceration is almost three times as much as the simple laceration, and the complex laceration is about five times as much as the simple laceration. Now, I know you guys have very well ingrained in us not to use the words approximately or about when we're describing how much a lac is, because then we automatically have to drop it down. But let's say I'm going to repair it and it was, I don't know, maybe 2.5, 2.6, not a big deal which way it is, right? Not really a big deal whether it was one or the other.
It's a very big deal. Let me put it this way. I've been through now three RAC audits. I've been doing this since 1981, and we've never paid back a dime. And that's almost unheard of. And I want to keep it that way. I do not want to pay back money. No, it's a very big deal. And it's important for all of you to learn that as well. So however you're going to practice now, get it down in your residency, it will absolutely reward you when you go out into practice. So however you're going to learn to measure accurately.
So if that's carrying around a little laminated tape measure, if that's measuring my fingers and my fingernails and my wrist and everything else, somehow figure out what is a constant for me and do that every time the same way.
Yeah. I'm very proud of our faculty because I will sometimes send it back. You know, we will not have the present statement we need, another whole set of rules, but we won't have what we need for a specific pair. And I'll send it back, and I am proud of them. They'll say, you know what, I don't recall that I was there, number one, and number two, I don't recall this size.
Now, is it a difference as far as billing whether or not we close with sutures, staple, glue, does it matter?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. And it depends on the pair. Peg, why don't you take it on the glue?
Dermabond, if Dermabond is used or any glue substance, Medicare, we can bill Medicare for that. Otherwise, with the other pairs, we will bill the LAC codes for those. They don't recognize the Dermabond.
Staples and sutures?
Same as sutures.
Same mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. As far as our medical decision making, I feel like a lot of us spend a lot of time focusing on maybe what the actual procedure was, but not much about what went into deciding we need to sew up this lac. What can you comment on for the medical decision making part of the or the emergency department course that we dictate that leads up to, and I sewed up this lac?
Exactly. Extremely important. Extremely important. As you know, we have five levels of ENM, okay? The first level is never really with a lac. First one is patient comes in, has more of a puncture wound, and maybe they need a tetanus. So you're basically giving them a shot, and that's a level one. But levels 2, 3, and 4, and what went into them, extremely important to differentiate. We're looking for high mechanism injury from a height, you know, that there was possible loss of consciousness. Did you think of any additional testing? Because you're really concerned about, what, regardless of where the lac is, what about the head? You know, did you have to think about that? And so, yes, you're right. I mean, it can get really careless. And remember, it isn't that the chart is blank. We can only send it back to you if a section is blank. Otherwise, we're coaching. Otherwise, we're saying, please fill in this box right here, and we'll get a higher level. Can never do that. So what do the coders do? They downcode. So they'll take it right down to a level 2 when they're positive. You wouldn't get a lac like this if it weren't a level 4, but we can't. So go down to a level 2 and build the lac.
It's nice to know someone else is keeping us honest on the documentation besides ourselves. So. All right, so we put this suture in, we've done our lac repair, we've counseled our patient, we finished our documentation, and then they come back and they see someone else. Right. And someone else sees them, the lac looks great, they take them out and they sign their chart and send them home. What's kind of changed about that with suture removal? Do we really care that they're coming back to have their sutures taken out?
Yeah, we do. Medicare basically, about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, decided that they were never seeing the suture removal charge, even though it was a zero charge. So they felt that a lot of patients in their follow-up were going back to their PCPs for removal rather than coming back to an emergency department. So they quit paying for the global. So that's what it used to be called. It was a 10-day global. So they pay you on day one for 10 days of care. They no longer do that. They will pay us for suture removal, but we need it to be documented. Not extensively, obviously. You're only going to get a level one, but we do need a couple of words in HPI, a couple of, you know, basically, you know, give us a description of the exam, and then the decision-making is straightforward.
All right. Any closing thoughts for our residents about LAX?
You know, I often have thought how unfair to the person we really get it right. I've seen as many as 4 and 5 LAX on one patient, going up to $3,000 or $4,000. And the very next patient, zero? I mean, I've often thought, don't ever let it be the two members of the same family. I mean, they're going to wonder, and I'm not going to be able to have a good answer. Somebody was careful, conscientious, and somebody wasn't.
Or the attending was not able to get in the room and was not present during the, the key and critical portion of that LAX repair.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, both of you. Well, I sincerely hope you guys got something out of that. Again, this is not something that we are trying to push on you as faculty so that you can earn us more money so we can buy nicer cars. Any of you that have seen my car know that's the case. What we're trying to do is help you to develop good habits so that when you graduate from residency, you will be able to buy nice cars. And this was supposed to be for your benefit, so if you find that you enjoyed it, didn't enjoy it, too long, too short, something else that you guys want to hear about, please let us know. We are also going to include some discussions on medical legal documentation. And if we're lucky, maybe we can even get some Peter Rosenisms when he comes over the winter. So to round this out, we want to have another clinical pearls discussion. This is something that Jared and I did last time, which was really just our opinion. And we figured maybe you'd like to hear some more opinions. So this month we're going to talk about the very basics of running a code. And when I mean basics, I don't mean ACLS, I don't mean BLS. I mean how to not wet yourself in the middle of a code and actually run the room. This is, although basic, one of the most difficult things that I have personally had to master in a code is how to control your own emotions, control your own crazy mind that's going all over the place, and coordinate the care of a patient that's in extremis. So we've got several people that I have interviewed, and we're going to give you their opinions, the way they think of codes, and I think you'll see that they all have very, very different places that they're coming from when they're preparing and they hear that there's a code arrest coming in. So this month we're going to be talking about how to run a code in general. And luckily I happened to walk by and see Sage walking by dressed very nicely and pulled him out of wherever he was going, probably to lunch, and into a dark room to be able to talk to you guys about codes. So Sage is going to give some of his wisdom about how he kind of sets up for a code, how he thinks of the code as it's progressing, and just how to make it run well for those of you that have run many, few, or none.
All right. Well, thanks, Leach. So you guys are going to hear a lot of different things about how to set up the room, how to communicate. You guys have all done ACLS. You guys all know the drugs, the rhythms, the doses. You guys know about closed-loop communication. So the only thing I want to add to that, one of my favorite sayings is the sicker the patient, the further you should be from the bed. In other words, you need the leader to be standing at the foot of the bed or further away. That person does not get to do procedures. That person's not hooking up the pads. They're not reaching for drugs. You have to delegate out, but there's got to be somebody with a bird's eye view. And so what is that bird's eye view? So from the attending level, looking at the forest rather than the trees, there are 5 immediate questions that you need to answer during a cardiac arrest. And these 5 questions have a lot to do with what does the evidence and literature really tell us about how to save someone's life in cardiac arrest. There are really 5 things that matter. The first is the quality of chest compressions. So rather than fight over the airway, the IVs, the IO, or any of the drugs, I care about quality chest compressions. And if they're not being done, that's the first thing that I'm going to correct. I don't care if they're intubated or not. There's really not anything I care about except for quality chest compressions. So that's first and foremost, and that's shown to save lives more than a lot of other things we do. Number 2, are there rhythms that we can defibrillate? Nothing saves a patient in cardiac arrest like the timely defibrillation of a shockable rhythm. So after the chest compressions are going and they are quality, I care immediately about what rhythm the patient is in and whether the pads are on the patient. We know very well that any drug that we give, any airway maneuver we do, any of these other little things really don't add to neurologic survival, except shocking someone in VFib or VTAC will. So the first thing is quality chest compressions. The second thing is shock the shockable rhythms. The third thing that saves people's lives is whether or not they need to go to catheter or not. If you've got a primary cardiac arrest that's a VFib or a VTAC arrest, whether or not you ever see ST elevation, these patients need to go to cath. So treat your cardiac arrests like a STEMI alert. Multiple studies have found that a significant proportion of patients in a VFib or VTAC arrest have critical coronary lesions that can be stented. They don't ever have to show you ST elevation, so don't worry about that 12 lead getting your pulse back. Call the cardiologist and make them make a decision. So number one, quality chest compressions. Number two, shock the shockable rhythm. Number three, get your cardiologist down to the room and talk about going to the cath lab. The fourth thing that really, really matters is cooling the patient. And you don't have to cool right away, but you do need to cool within the first couple hours. And the method of cooling does not matter. One of my pet peeves is to see my chest compressor and all my other personnel get pushed out of the way to put on an Arctic sun blanket that just interrupts your compressions and your procedures. All you need are a few bags of ice, go behind the neck, go in the armpits, go in the groin, just get the patient naked, put some ice on them, the rest will get sorted out later. Cooling people matters. And at least the trend currently for the American Heart Association is that we should be cooling everyone with a cardiac arrest unless you've got a really good reason, like a brain bleed or like they're a trauma patient. We really should be cooling everybody irregardless of their presenting rhythm. So number one, quality chest compressions. Number two, shock the shockable rhythm. Number three, get the patient to cath. Number four, put some ice on them. And then number five, a little bit of a more general sort of thing, is number five is where you get to worry about reversible causes. Not everybody with a cardiac arrest has a coronary lesion. You've got to think about whether they're in PEA. Do they need oxygen and fluids? Yes. If they're in PEA arrest, they need fluids. They do need their airway managed. They'll need to be intubated. Could they have hyperkalemia? Could this be tamponade, pneumothorax? If you've got a patient like asthma, COPD, or what have you, at risk for pneumothorax, go ahead and put a finger in both sides of their chest. Think about your reversible causes. And those are the only five things that matter. Those are the five things that save lives. I don't care when you give your epi. I don't care when you give your amiodarone. The drugs don't matter. The IV site doesn't matter. That surely having a central line does not matter. What matters is quality chest compressions, shock the shockable rhythm, get the patient to cath, put some ice on them, and think about reversible causes if they do in fact have a PEA rhythm, and you've got a list of those in your pocket. That's my two cents. Leach, been a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Man, that dude is smart. All right, just so you all know, Sage recorded that in one take, and I really didn't have to edit anything. That's how smart he is he just kind of spouts this all off the top of his head. Whereas I have to make copious notes and try to remind myself with strings tied around my fingers. So in quick review of what Sage said, the five most important things, chest compressions, shockable rhythms, go to cardiac cath or not, cooling, and look for reversible causes of cardiac arrest. Those are great pearls. And just to expound on something Sage had mentioned, I guarantee you if you try to run a code with Sage and you tell him that you don't need a central line or don't need epi, he will quickly correct you. What he's trying to point out for this purposes of this podcast are the biggest things that we need to be concerned about. We'll get our central access, we'll get our epinephrine in, we'll hang our fluids, we'll get our pressors once we get our rhythm back. These are the things you can do to try to get a rhythm back. So these are great pearls if your patient is code arrest, medical code, found down, 80 years old. Let's say your patient is 25 years old. was minding their own business, walking to church, and suddenly, two dudes come out of nowhere, stab and shoot your patient. Now he's in arrest. Now who are you going to call?
So to continue with our opinions, we have Dr. Terrence O'Keefe, one of our trauma surgeons, who graciously agreed to take time out of his busy schedule from cutting people and talk to us real quick. So we're going to ask him the similar question. We're going to say that you have a patient that's coming in who's either lost pulses en route from penetrating or blunt injury, or they lost pulses when they got here. What goes through your mind as you now realize that this is a code arrest, a trauma code, that I'm going to have to run rather than just a typical trauma resuscitation?
So, and it depends slightly on whether it is blunt or penetrating, because if it's blunt, I'm a little bit more negative about the patient's chances. But we have a thing that Dr. Fries likes to bring up, this AABBCCDD thing. Instead of ABCs for trauma, you have airway and you have ACLS drugs. And you have breathing, bilateral chest use for the blunt angle of conflict. You have circulation, you're doing CPR. Disability, consider DPL. We don't really have an E. And for me, one of the critical things for blunt agonal trauma patient who was arrested is the FAST exam. If I specifically FAST exam, I'm looking for signs of cardiac activity. If they come in, they've got no rhythm, no pulse, no signs of cardiac activity, then unless they literally did it as they're taking them off the out of the ambulance onto the gurney, bring them in, I'm probably going to call it. I have had no luck with blunt CPR patients, so I'm really very interested in seeing what that ultrasound is, and that's one of the first things I ask on the room. Penetrating, slightly different. We can be a little bit more aggressive, particularly the stretch of the time right now to about 15 minutes. Some of the things may also be similar depending on what the scenario is. Keeping the room organized, that's difficult. You need to set the ground rules before they come in. And unfortunately, I'm a bit of a shouter, so if people start getting too loud, then I'll just try and shout them down, try and get them back on track. But for example, if I know it's a patient who's not going to do well, then I'll try and just calm the room down. But it is very difficult. The worst ones are the pediatrics. Pediatrics, everyone gets so intense and head up, it's very difficult to maintain composure, particularly as the family normally at the edge of the room, which has been my experience here. It's very difficult for everyone.
Very good.
Now, I wanted to break in here real quick and reiterate something Dr. O'Keefe had said as far as his AABBCCDD. I wanted to reiterate it because not only could you not hear him being in the trauma bay, but I thought it was a very eloquent way to come about this approach. AA is airway and ACLS drugs. BB would be breathing, supporting the breathing, as well as bilateral chest tubes. CC would be circulation and CPR, so that's continuing CPR, as well as trying to identify places where your circulation is leaking and trying hemorrhage control anywhere you can. And the last one being DD, disability, and DPL, or in this day and age, FAST exam, since we're really not doing diagnostic peritoneal lavage anymore. Anyway, I thought that was a great mantra to go into a trauma code with so that you can try to follow the incredible symphony that is an ED thoracotomy.
So let's say we have one of these trauma codes, we do a great resuscitation, and we get return of spontaneous circulation. At what point do you feel, I'm taking this patient to the OR, I can do that safely, they will survive the 2 minutes, 2 minutes it takes to push them over to the OR?
So Dr. Rhee has a nice phraseology he likes to develop. He basically talks about these patients taking you down the alley and then mugging you when you go too far down the alley with you. I've had a number of patients who we've had ROSC, and I've gone down the alleyway, taken them to the operating room, and then been thoroughly mugged in the operating room. And I've yet to have a survivor from an EV or resuscitated thoracotomy in the emergency room. So I personally now have gotten to the point where I'm going to sit and wait and make sure that patient actually survives his resuscitation. It's going to give me 5 minutes of stability. I remember very distinctly when the first season of ER came on, they were basically given about 2 seconds before they go, "They're stable. Let's take them to the operating room." I don't think we're helping anyone like that, because what happens is that patient will code again between here and the OR, even though it's only a 60-second transport time. So I will give them a chance to prove to me that they're going to fail before I leave the ED.
And then all of the other things that we can do. We have massive transfusion protocol. We have all of these procedures we can start doing. Aside from that, any style points that you would share with our residents as they're trying to learn how to do these and eventually to run one of these on their own, whether they're in an academic center or a community hospital that gets a trauma code, any pearls for them? that you'd like to share?
Just keep thinking ahead. So one of the disadvantages of actually putting patients into single roles is, oh, putting people rather into single roles, is that once they do that role, they then kind of stand back and kind of go, okay, I'm done, I did my role. So you need to be thinking ahead. So after you've intubated them, what comes next after intubation? Okay, let me go ahead and reassess the for cranial facial trauma. Let me put an OG tube in. Let me listen to the lungs again now I've intubated them. And I see a lot of people in the trauma bay sometimes, they've done their single job, whatever it is, and then they stand back. No, you can do other things to help. Did someone get the bloods? No, okay, fine, let's go down to the femoral artery and stick something. Did we get the Foley in? Keep the resuscitation moving and keep it going, and that will minimize the amount of time you spend here in the trauma bay. Hopefully, maximize our patient survival.
All right, so we're going to keep going here. We have another trauma specialist. We have Lisa, our NP. When you have a trauma code that is coming in, that's all you get is you get EMS ring down coming in 2 minutes, trauma code, unknown mechanism. What are you getting set in your mind and in your room?
In my mind, I just want to make sure that we're prepared for any possible situation. So make sure that we have the chest tube setups available for us, that we have the ED thoracotomy tray available for us, that we have IV fluid prime that's on blood tubing so that we have instant access for them if we need it. Because oftentimes what happens when EMS does arrive, they may have one IO or they may have a line that's not secured. If you have something primed and ready to go, you don't have to worry about stopping for that additional delay. The other thing I'd like to do is to make sure that the teams are organized. So everyone clearly has an idea of what they're going to be doing. And oftentimes, when a patient arrives, everything kind of just goes crazy. And if we end up having to open a chest, people lose sight of what their roles really are. So it's important that one person step up to the plate and say, hey, where are we going next or what are we doing next?
So what things have you noticed that help differentiate a trauma code that's going to be run very smoothly from one that's going to end in misery?
But what the trauma codes that run very smoothly are ones that we have a little more information about. Is it a penetrating injury? Is it a blunt injury? If we know that it's a penetrating chest wound, it guides our resuscitation differently than if we have no information whatsoever. Sometimes the problem is that when we do have that information, people get so focused that they forget that there's a rest of the body that potentially has injury. So, again, having somebody who can stand back and not necessarily be an active participant, but guide everybody and say, hey, I need you to do this, I need you to do that.
We just had a guy that he had a penetrating injury to the neck, and so everyone's focused on the neck, and he lost pulses en route, and as soon as we realized his airway was patent, it was like, uh-oh, what trajectory did this bullet go, and is it now in his head, or is it in his chest, or is it in his knee? Who knows where this thing ended up, so very good point. All right, any other pearls you have for our residents that say maybe aren't going to have a trauma team at the place where they work, but still have the luxury of taking care of people who are shot, stabbed, maimed in some horrible way?
Stay calm and take a deep breath. Everybody gets treated the same way. If you treat everybody and run through the protocols exactly the same way, you will survive. It's the biggest issue is to not get lost by one specific injury that you just have to keep going through. Everybody gets treated exactly the same way, that you always follow the same algorithm with your management.
So the guy who got his hand caught in the hay baler still gets airway breathing circulation first?
Everybody gets airway breathing circulation, disability exposure. Now, granted, it may all happen at the same time by multiple providers, but you always still follow A, B, C, D, E. And it's even more important when you don't have a whole crew of people that you go through that in order to make sure you don't miss anything that could potentially kill them later. So one thing I want to make a point of for you guys that's really important is when the trauma team is actually doing like an ED thoracotomy or clamshelling somebody, we have lost our role as directors of the care, and especially when we're doing, you know, compressions, internal compressions. It's really important at that point that you guys step up to the plate and start running the actual code, so making sure that they're getting the appropriate epinephrine, bicarbs, calciums, whatever it is, and that you also help us out with access, because at this point, our aim and our focus is purely on stitching whatever we can find, and we may not always have the help to put in all the other accesses. So it is really important for me and extremely helpful for me that you guys step up to the plate and continue to run that stuff for us, because we're not focused at that point. So any help that you can give us that way, and be it one person that says, I need, you know, ED resident junior this name to put in a femoral line down here or a central line here. We're not thinking of that, so please, please, please feel free to step up. And it will be greatly appreciated.
Probably really nice to look up from your thoracotomy and see a cordis in every other vessel that you're not actively working on.
Correct.
Okay. And that's a good point. One of the trauma surgeons told me one time when a patient went into VTAC, he goes, okay, guys, do your medical thing. We're going to keep doing our trauma thing. And we really do have both roles that we need to take care of in these trauma codes.
So again, I'm sorry that the quality there wasn't as good as it could have been, but recording in the trauma bay doesn't lend itself to very good quality. Dr. O'Keefe rightly mentioned that pediatric codes can often be some of the worst. We often try harder, longer, not wanting to give up on a pediatric code. I wanted to give you my quick spiel on what I do when I prepare for a code. And this is, again, with all of my year of experience, this is stuff that I've stolen, borrowed, observed other people do that has worked very well for me. Specifically, this is another thing I've stolen from Ash Panchal, who's at OHSU now. He always told me that when he hears there's a code coming in, there's a few things that he'll start to assemble, and he'll start to stockpile it in the room where the patient's going to be. The first thing he does is he gets his equipment, and his equipment means all of his airway equipment. All the different tube sizes, all the different blade sizes, all the different backups that he's going to need, and he has it all handy and at arm's reach. The next thing he gets is his code cart. He gets all of his appropriate size pads. He gets everything else he needs. If you're in the PEDS ED, that might mean that you grab the Braslow cart and actually have an idea of where it's at. Grabbing a Braslow tape to go with the Braslow cart is always a good idea as well. He gets everything ready for his access. He gets central lines, be it a cordis if you think someone's going to be bleeding out, or a triple lumen because you're going to need to give multiple pressures and fluids at the same time. That can also be just getting an IO for starters, whether it's an adult or a kid. Get your monitors ready and make sure that you have personnel that's ready to put it on. Now in the great day of ultrasound, we have ultrasounds handy to be able to look at the squeeze of the heart, to be able to try to find reversible causes of an arrest. And the most important thing initially is to try to get some hands. Get as many hands as you possibly can at the beginning, and you can always send people outside of the room if it becomes too crowded. But you don't want to be at a loss for people to do the role that you want. Now, being that there are a lot of different roles, you need to have one person that's the team leader. And that's the boss that needs to be loud, take charge, make sure everyone knows that they are the one that information is going to be flowing through, and they're the ones that are going to be assigning roles. I always make sure that I have my very basic ACLS roles assigned. Who's doing airway? Who's putting on my monitor? Who's getting my access? Who's recording? Who's doing chest compressions? And who's giving my drugs? As long as I have those roles assigned, I know that people are going to do those until they're done. My job at that point is to oversee the rest of the code and to try to get info from EMS. The info I'm specifically going for, besides any other pertinent patient history, is how long have they been down, what was their presentation when you got there, what were their vitals when you got there, and what rhythms have they been through. Have you given them any drugs, whether they took some at home or you gave them some en route? And any known past medical history or medications that you know about them. That's a quick history that you can get from EMS that will give you a great head start on your code. The next thing I do is I have one of the residents, and this is something I would do when I was a senior resident as well, is I would have one of my junior residents or even one of my interns, depending on where we're at in the year and how comfortable everybody is, be the procedure monkey. There's someone else who's doing airway breathing circulation, usually several someones that are doing airway or on circulation trying to get access or even putting in chest tubes if need be. But that's not where I need to be. I don't need to be in the airway putting in the tube. I don't need to be in the groin or the chest trying to put in a central line. I need to be at the foot of the bed overseeing everybody or right at the patient's groin feeling for a pulse during pulse checks. Now let's say we get him back. A lot of times I have personally floundered when I get a patient back. So first thing I start to ask for, my favorite lab for any sick patient, VBG with lights and lactase and a finger stick glucose so that we know where they're at. After that, I order any lab that I can abbreviate, CBC, CMP, lactate, coags, and we start to cool them. We get them some post-resuscitation pressors, and after that, I defer to Sage. I loved what Sage had to say, and I thought it was very, very applicable. For kids, the biggest differences is you have less square footage to work on. You don't have people spread out on the bed because the patient doesn't take up the whole bed. So making sure that you've appropriately managed the space around your patient is very important. I try to keep my pediatric quick card close by so that I can always look up drug doses. I will try to estimate a weight ahead of time if I can, or use the Braslow right when the patient shows up and start actually writing the code doses or the RSI doses on the bed sheet so that everyone else can look at them and help me verify my math. Because in that situation, I don't trust myself. I don't trust myself to do it in my head. I pull out my phone or my calculator and I make sure that the doses are as correct as I can get them. And I try to keep everything as calm and as quiet as possible. I like to try not to yell on top of yelling, but I'll just very loudly say, I need the room to be quieter. And generally people respond well, the room quiets down, the resuscitation goes a lot more smoothly, and people can actually hear what's going on. I will often reiterate, this is where we're at, this is where we're going, has anyone done this, has this been done, when was our last this? Just to try to clarify with everyone in the room in an otherwise fairly quiet room so that everyone can hear what's been going on so that I make sure I don't miss anything. And I think the most striking thing is that we will often have family watching our code arrests in kids. And it's very important for the family. It's incredibly nerve-wracking for us. Those of you that have even done a spinal tap on a baby when the parents are in the room, feel that pressure on you. Now think about it in a code. But it's not about us. It's about the child, and it's about the family that that child belongs to. And we find that in research that it's very helpful to have the family be in the code for their grieving process, for their ability to understand how hard we've worked for their child. And we will often run codes a lot longer on kids than we would for adults because kids tend to do better than adults overall. But pediatric codes are a very difficult time that you need to make sure after you've run one of those, successful or not, that you have somebody you can go talk to because those things will suck the life out of you. So I'm sitting in my office recording this, and I swear to you, this is the fifth ambulance that I have heard in the background in the last 5 minutes. Which makes me very happy I'm in my office and not in the ED, but very poignant for this discussion on how to run codes. More than anything, it helps you remember that there are a lot of other people that are there with you running these codes. There are the paramedics that bring the patient in. There are the nurses that are doing all the things that you're barking out orders to do. There are the social workers that are behind providing the screen and getting your actual history for your patient. And I wanted to talk to them as well to see what in their minds helps differentiate a great code from a poorly run code.
What are you a movie star in? What movie were you in?
It was not in the movie. PBS followed the Verbay down here.
Really?
Yeah.
Can we get access to that somehow?
It'll be aired in February.
Nice. Awesome. All right. So for everybody who's listening to that, Melissa, one of our RNs, is going to be a PBS star come February. So keep those of you that DVR PBS anyway.
Yeah, Sesame Street.
Yeah, exactly. She's going to be counting gunshot wounds on Sesame Street. All right.
Right.
So we're in the trauma bay, and luckily it is 2:30 in the afternoon. It's almost trauma 30, so we're going to catch Melissa before we actually get started with the busyness, and we're going to ask her how she runs a code. So Melissa has been an emergency nurse for a while, and she is one of the ones that taught me how to run codes successfully. So I'm going to ask her opinion on, first of all, when you hear that there's a medical code coming in, what kind of things do you do to start to get prepared for your room?
We'll get the airway roll definitely ready. We'll have the room kind of cleared out because, our rooms are way too small as it is. If we don't have our illustrious pharmacist at in our pocket, we will get the medical code stuff. So basically, we just have to make sure our people are available, that we have our airway roll, we call on respiratory, have them close by. We'd like to know who the attending and who the resident is, and you know, and hope that it's a resident that's been here for more than a minute.
No offense to those of you that haven't been.
None. No offense.
But you know that if you were coming in coding, you wouldn't want you taking care of you either. So.
I don't think I'd want me taking care of me on many occasions.
All right, so we have the room all set up, and that's one of the things that most people have said so far, is the biggest things that they need is hands. They need hands nearby. And then as soon as you have plenty of hands, you start getting rid of hands.
Yes.
You start shoving people out of the room.
Absolutely. Because, you know, once we have, if the attending or even the resident who, you know, feels confident enough to run the code is, you know, delegating orders, you know, effectively and confidently, then, you know, really, you know, less is better in there. One person can, you know, hear what the doc is ordering, you know, what needs to be given next. We have access to it. We have room to get it. If we need, you know, if we're innovating, respiratory is right there. So when it's running smoothly, less is better.
Okay, so the code arrives, EMS starts rolling the patient in, and then what kind of things start the code off on a good note, as if you could start a code off on a good note. What kind of things let you know, all right, this is going to be a well-run code versus a train wreck?
When we can, you know, when we get a good report from EMS, and, you know, that doesn't always happen, but if, you know, when we do get a, you know, a good report and they've got a good history, they can tell us a, you know, an accurate account of what has happened, what they saw, what they started initiating prior to arrival. And then if we can get our hands on this patient and get him on the monitor, we can see, you know, where he's headed or, you know, what's going on. And we can start right away, then we know things usually run smoothly from that point.
So what do you like the person who's leading the code to actually do in order to have it run successfully?
I like them to, you know, take that authoritative lead and know, be familiar with the people in the room, be familiar with who knows what, you know, can make direct contact with those people and say, it's know and say what they need.
What kind of things happen in the code that let you know this is going to be an absolute disaster?
when somebody keeps yelling, what's going on here? What's happening?
Where's that bleeding coming from?
Why is that monitor making that noise? Then we know, yeah, then it's bad.
Does anyone recognize that squiggle?
What does this mean?
All right. So, all in all, what part of the resuscitation, when you have a code arrest, what part do you think gets to be the most confusing? Do you think it's the first part? Do you think it's actually the return of circulation that gets confusing? What do you think kind of throws people off?
You know, I think it kind of depends on who's running it, at, you know, from the beginning, because I think there's a lot of people that, you know, are strong starters, and maybe, you know, we get a little weak in the finishing, like, yeah, when we have a return of, you know, resus, then it's like, okay, then what do? We cool the patient, we warm the patient, where's the patient going? So that really kind of depends. I would say more often it's the after that gets a little bit
any particular pearls, any one thing that you kind of would like our newbies who maybe have never run a code or are starting to learn to run codes, what can they do to try to help facilitate the communication with the nursing staff and the medics and everyone else, the RTs and everyone else that's helping together as a unit to run this code?
I would say get to know us, like introduce yourself when you come in. Like, you know, I'm sure you've had to do it a zillion times as a newbie, but introduce yourself to the staff, to the respiratory, to the medics. And ask questions. That would be the biggest pearl I could, you know, suggest. And listen to, you know, what's going on in those codes.
All right, there you go. So if you guys actually want to run a code, you got to make sure that you know who you're talking to. It's definitely not a good idea to just walk in and say, "I'm in charge here, peons."
Absolutely. Bad things happen to you later.
Good for you.
Thank
yeah,
you very
exactly.
much for listening. All right. So the next nurse that we're going to talk to, this is Nick Crucius, one of the other nurses. Not as good as Melissa, but he's available. So
that's
we're going to ask him some of the
questions.
Okay.
I'm a body. Yeah, I got a pulse.
Whatever.
So, Nick, we're asking people about how they run codes, what they like about a good resuscitation, what's a good resuscitation, what's not so good of a resuscitation, so that the new residents, even some of the seniors who have run codes for a while, can kind of get an idea of what helps it run smoothly. So when you hear that there's a medical code coming in, what kind of things are going through your mind that you need to get ready, that you need to be prepared for, that you need to contribute to have this be a good resuscitation?
One thought I have is, you know, is pharmacy around or not? Is ED pharmacy present or not? If ED pharmacy is around, then I'm less concerned about grabbing the drug, the code bin that we have our drugs in. If they're not around, then I'm going to have to grab that. I want to make sure that we have the compression stool nearby so that we can do adequate compressions, that we have adequate people around to do compressions, and that we have airway supplies and ID stuff nearby, ultrasound nearby, so we can get so we can do what we need to do accordingly.
What's that piece of equipment that you kind of feel like, no matter how well prepared you are, it's like, we never have this. We can't find this piece of equipment. If only we had this.
The step stool.
A step stool?
A step stool for compressions. That's the one thing that's like, we can't find this one thing, and that's the only thing we need, because that's the biggest, at least, very basically, that's the basic thing that we need in order to do adequate, decent compressions.
Now, how tall are you?
5'11".
And do you still use a step stool?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
I'm 6'3", I still use a step stool, and it just really helps you get right over top of the patient and not tire out and get good chest compression.
And the other thing that's really big about that, too, is that, you know, unfortunately, it's not just all about you when you're doing compressions. You gotta have you wanna have the bed up at an adequate height so that you know the airway person can do the airway when the time comes. That you know everybody is you know not bent over you know slaving over this patient. You wanna you know those typically are not just 5 minutes and you're done.
How often do you feel like you actually know who's in charge of the code?
Okay.
Medical codes, mm-hmm. I would say 50 to 75% of the time.
Trauma codes.
Good answer. Less than 25, for sure.
It can definitely be a little more confusing the more people you have in the room.
Absolutely, hands down.
So, what is one thing that you've seen doctors do when they're running codes that just seems to throw the room into a cluster?
When they're in a cluster, when they're like all confuzzled and just you know not clear on what they want and what's next, even if it's wrong, having a plan of attack is hands down, medical or trauma is what needs to happen.
Now, you've done a lot of recording when mm-hmm. you do code. So as the recorder who's sitting in the corner watching this circus happen, what kind of things help you to know what's going on so you can help keep the pace of the code?
A loud, clear voice, what's going on, things that, especially more so the trauma ones, things I can't see. Being on one side of the bed, so, like the foot or whatever, I can't see the whole everything that's going on for the patient themselves. So I need to have somebody tell me what they're actually seeing, what they're doing, things like that.
Okay, then maybe
any advice for our newbies when they get in and it's their turn and they decide they're going to run the code?
Be loud, be clear, know what you want, know your basics of your algorithms. Don't be afraid to use your G card.
Okay.
All spells epi. Epi until you're blue in the face or the patient, whichever one comes first. And like Leslie said a few minutes ago too, you know, introduce yourselves. Especially if we don't know you quite yet. Which you know, hopefully by the end of your first year we'll know you pretty well, but nonetheless.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I found is really helpful too, is if you can introduce yourself while you're assigning roles. Who's putting my monitor leads on?
Correct.
Oh, you are. Hi, Aaron. Nice to meet you. Who's getting my IV access? Who's doing my meds? Who's doing recording. These are all good things. So you can simultaneously meet your people and make sure that you have all the important roles already set.
Absolutely.
Great. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, Aaron.
All right, so we have another very important person here that we're going to talk to. This is Mindy, one of our social workers, and Mindy has a very crucial role. While we're running the code, she's usually on the outside looking in and trying to coordinate everything that's going on outside of the room. So, Mindy, why don't you let us in on exactly what it is you do while we're inside running our resuscitation?
So one of the first things I do is I communicate with EMS. And that is to find out what happened, where it happened, and who in the family may have been notified already. Sometimes folks are coming from care facilities. I need to be able to coordinate getting family present.
So when you're looking into one of these codes, what kind of things do you notice about a code, just from having seen a few of these? What are some of the features of a code that seems to be running well versus a code that is not running so well?
Not a lot of background noise, clear communication, people not talking over one another, loud and directive in terms of whoever's running it, and clear communication between everyone.
So when you're on the outside, you're getting the history and everything. You're usually our buffer between family members and what we need to do for their loved ones. So what is your approach when you're outside with the family members? Do you have them stay outside the resuscitation bay? Do you have them in the room? Do you escort them out? What's kind of your approach?
So oftentimes we have family members either in the ambulance with the patient or immediately following the ambulance, and so they are present from the very beginning in the trauma. If they are present immediately and they choose to stay, then I will stay with them. It's my job to manage them in terms of if their behavior is appropriate. If I have someone who at any time is disruptive to medical staff or to medical treatment, then I will take them out. But by and large, people manage to hold it together at least enough outside the room. If I've got somebody who shows up after the person's already back in the trauma bay, if it's a child, almost exclusively we will bring the parent back immediately unless the parent has another preference, even in a code situation. If it's an adult, then depending on what is happening and what the circumstances are, we will bring that person back. Sometimes our codes are related to, I guess more towards the trauma codes. If it's related to a criminal activity, then I am not permitted by law enforcement to contact family right away.
That's good to know. So you are usually the face we see after we've either successfully resuscitated the patient, we're high-fiving each other, or we have not successfully resuscitated the patient and we're kind of upset at ourselves. And you usually the face that we see saying, who's going to talk to the family? So we're going to talk on a later episode about that actual discussion with the family. But just as a preface into that, what kind of things can we do ahead of time after a code, whether it's successful or not, to try to prepare for that interaction with the family?
Probably the two biggest things would be to know the patient's name if it's available. We usually have that with social work, or at the very least we can find it for you. The second thing would be to at least have a basic understanding of what the situation was that led to the code, so that you're not asking questions that might be very basic or offensive to the family.
Anything else you'd kind of suggest to us?
Well, two things, I think. One is that we have a ninja-like ability to get family back in the trauma bay without you guys knowing that they're there, because you're very busy resuscitating a patient. You're not paying attention to what's happening outside of the room. So please be aware of what it is that you're saying and how you're saying it, particularly around the time that death might be called, or you just don't know who your audience is, so be mindful of that. The second thing is, particularly when you are aware that there is a family member present, if there is someone, and there usually are, a resident or two that are not actively engaged in the resuscitation but are nearby in case something additional is needed or another piece of equipment, it's been very helpful in the past if I have that one resident come out and give me updates every once in a while as to what exactly is going on, so I can continue to keep the family informed.
That's really good. Yeah, I think a lot of us have our own ways of dealing with a bad situation like this, and some of us might get angry, some of us might make a joke, some of us might get angry and make a joke and make a very dark joke. I know I've probably said some very off-color things in a room, hoping that the family's not around, and it's not I'd be horrified to turn around and actually see someone there. I actually had one family member of a patient we were resuscitating that ended up being one of the docs that was working on a different service that day and happened to be on and was in the doc box while we were looking at some of their lab work and imaging. And it was, you know, we didn't know that even the doc box isn't 100% safe, of where you can just say whatever you want. So yeah, do be careful of what you guys actually let fly from your mouths in a high pressure situation like that. So
yeah.
Awesome. Well, that's great, Mindy. Thank you very much. And we'll talk to you in a couple episodes when we start talking about how to break the bad news. And what did you call it? The bad room?
The bad news room.
The bad news room. Mm-hmm. Also known as RME. Thanks, Mindy. always awesome to get input from our nurses and our social workers. So if you do see Nick or Melissa or Mindy, please tell them thank you for their advice and their experience. We're going to finish off by letting Jared Mosier do his rant on how he likes to run a code. I think in summary, before Jared re-summarizes, I think the things that are most well highlighted by everybody is to take control of the room, to keep the room quiet. A quiet code is a good code. And to assign roles as early and as often as necessary in order to keep everything running smoothly. Jared, why don't you wrap up for us?
So here are my tips on how to run a code. The first is that while you're preparing for the patient to arrive, or in the first 20 to 30 seconds of the patient's arrival, you need to think about the most common things that could be leading to that arrest. For example, if the patient was short of breath, then you automatically start thinking about respiratory causes of that code. If they were complaining of chest pain, or if they're coming in with chest pain, they have a pre-hospital EKG that looks like acute coronary syndrome, then you need to think about cardiac reasons. If they're a dialysis patient, you need to worry about electrolyte reasons, hyperkalemia. The next most important thing is that you need to take control of the room. Let me say that again. You need to take control of the room. This is the skill that I see them lacking most often, in that they come in and they're focused on what they want to do, but they don't do a very good job of controlling everybody else in the room. And if you don't initiate the fact that you are the one in control, then someone else will try. And this is where you get people who start calling out ridiculous things like, can somebody get the fast machine, etc. So what I recommend is that when you walk in the room, you assign people roles. You are going to be the procedure person. You are the airway person. You three people are swapping out chest compressions. To take that one step further, when you're in the middle of the code and you need something, you need a chest tube set up, look at somebody, look them in the eye, say their name if you can, if you remember it, and say, I need you to go get me a chest tube set up. If you just start calling out, somebody give me a chest tube set up, nobody wants to leave that room because everybody wants to stay there and be a part of that code. So you need to direct people. You need to be the leader of that situation. And keep in mind that they all took ACLS too. They all took ATLS. They don't really need you. Your role is to lead them in that resuscitation and to think about things outside the box that don't really fit inside that algorithm. Lastly, what you need to do is you need to take control of your own reaction, your own vital signs. It is not helpful if you are bouncing off the walls and freaking out and breathing fast. It's just going to make everybody else lose confidence and faith in you. So you need to speak calmly. You need to take control of your own situation, even if you're freaking out on the inside. So those three things, I would say, are the most important things about running a code. The rest of it will come with time. When you establish control or establish leadership in the room, that includes you need to establish that with your attending. And you should be the one running the code, not the attending. The attending should be standing in the back or standing to the side and being there as guidance for you, but should not be running the code. That should be your job. So if you don't step up and take control, your attending is likely going to be the one to step in, and then you've just lost out on that opportunity. So happy to help if anybody has any questions. But those are my 2 cents on how to run a code. Actually, I take that back. There's one other piece of advice I wanted to give. And that is, I don't really follow the algorithm to a T because I start ruling things out right away. For example, when a patient comes in coding, I always give them the same thing. I give them glucose, insulin, bicarb, and calcium, just to eliminate those things from the algorithm right away. Once you've eliminated those, then you start going down the, is this respiratory, is it cardiac? But at least you've eliminated hypoglycemia, you've eliminated hyperkalemia and severe acidosis. So then you can start running down the other list. So there's my 3 cents.
Well, that does it for us at the end of this month. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it, got something good out of it. It was certainly longer than last time. Whether or not that's better, I don't know. Why don't you guys let me know? I decided not to put the CV workshop lecture on the podcast because we had sent out that email. You have all of the lectures from conference available on the Panopto website, which if you'd like that, you can email one of us and we're happy to set you up with it. Great reference for some of those lectures you really wanted to see but weren't able to make. If you have anything else that you want us to try to help you with to educate, please let us know and we'll do our best we can. Hopefully you enjoyed the podcast. Please let us know what you want to hear about next month. So happy August. Enjoy your new rotations. Next month we'll try to get this out on time, but I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Being an attending is really hard. It's a lot harder than I thought it was. I apologize to all of you who were my attendings that I ever made fun of. Keeps beating like a hammer.